KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The death of Pope Francis really is the experience for a lot of us of the death of a spiritual father.
Some conservative Catholics are using this moment of transition to express expectations for the new pope and critiques of the old one.
For Thursday, April 24th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, how deep cuts are affecting three parts of the federal government.
We'll talk to our correspondents who cover diplomacy, health, and the military.
Also, Florida's governor faces questions about how $10 million of state money went to fund a political campaign.
In the real world, right? If someone defrauded the state or a charity out of $10 million, they would go to prison.
Plus, the movie The Legend of Ochi was inspired by the filmmaker's own childhood adventures in the forest.
Growing up, I feel like I was always chasing the mysteries of nature.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Two federal judges have temporarily blocked the Trump administration's ability to withhold federal funding from public schools that have diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. More from NPR's Janaki Mehta.
The Trump administration had asked school leaders in all 50 states to submit letters certifying their schools wouldn't promote DEI programs. If they refused, the administration said schools would risk losing federal money, including Title I, which is aimed at low-income students around the country. Today was the deadline for state and local leaders to submit responses to the federal government. About a dozen Democratic state leaders refused to sign the document. Others signed on behalf of their local school leaders. In several Republican states did comply with the order. Now, two federal judges have ruled against the Trump administration temporarily preventing the U.S. Department of Education from enforcing the DEI orders it has sent to K-12 schools. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Officials say the Trump administration is restoring financial support for a landmark study of women's health, reversing a defunding decision that had shocked medical researchers. Studies represent critical contributions to our better understanding of women's health, said a statement from Andrew Nixon, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services. The news comes a day after NPR reported on the plan to cut the project's funding. The turnabout is coming as a relief for scientists. South Korea's biggest automaker, Hyundai, is shifting some production from Mexico to the U.S. to avoid being hit with tariffs. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul. U.S. and South Korean officials are due to begin talks on tariffs in Washington.
Hyundai said in a statement that it's established a task force to respond to U.S. tariffs. Measures include moving production of some Tucson crossover SUVs from Mexico to a plant in Montgomery, Alabama. Last month, Hyundai announced it'll invest $20 billion over the next 3 years to increase production of cars and parts in the U.S. In talks with U.S. counterparts, South Korean officials will seek relief from 25% U.S. tariffs on its auto exports. They may offer to purchase more U.S. energy and build ships for the U.S. President Trump has signaled he'll try to get South Korea to contribute more to the cost of stationing U.S. troops in South Korea. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
President Trump has signed an executive order aimed at opening up mining for critical minerals on the ocean floor. Senior officials speaking on condition of anonymity telling reporters there could be more than a billion metric tons of minerals, things like manganese, cobalt, nickel, copper, and rare earth elements, worth upwards of $300 billion to the U.S. economy over 10 years. Such undersea mining is not currently done on a large scale, and scientists and others are worried about possible environmental impacts. Stocks gained ground for a third straight session. The Dow rose 486 points today. The Nasdaq was up 457 points. This is NPR. The NFL draft begins tonight, and the winner of last year's Heisman Trophy, a genuine two-way player unlike anyone professional football has seen in decades, could be one of the first to be chosen. More from NPR's Becky Sullivan on Travis Hunter.
Hunter was one of the best wide receivers in college football last year. He got 96 passes for more than 1,200 yards, and that alone might be enough to get him drafted early. But he's also a great defender, a cornerback with 4 interceptions last season. In total, he played more than 80% of all offensive and defensive snaps for Colorado. That unique versatility has most experts rating him the best player available in the draft, though he might not go first overall. Quarterbacks are king in the NFL, and the Tennessee Titans, with a top overall pick, need one. They're expected to take Cam Ward from Miami. Other top picks could include the Penn State pass rusher Abdul Carter and the Heisman Trophy runner-up, running back Ashton Gentry from Boise State. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The Trump administration is now asking the Supreme Court to allow it to enforce a ban on transgender individuals in the military as legal challenges continue. The filing with the high court today comes in response to a federal appeals court siding with a lower court's temporary hold. A federal judge in Washington state has ruled in favor of several transgender military members who had challenged the ban, saying their firing would cause lasting damage to their careers. Crude oil futures prices moved modestly higher today as investors looked at a weaker dollar and some concerns about OPEC with mixed economic news. Oil rose 52 cents a barrel today to settle at $62.79 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A change in presidential administration used not to be such a big deal, at least not for government lifers, meaning career civil service staffers in the federal government working for whoever's in charge. Well, that has not been the case with this second Trump administration. Less than 100 days in, and at many government agencies, dysfunction and chaos are the result of funding cuts, layoffs, executive orders, new people in charge, and the speed at which President Trump has moved to enact his agenda. That is what NPR correspondents who cover the federal government are hearing, and we are going to hear from three of them now. Michelle Kellerman is our longtime diplomat correspondent covering the Department of State. Selena Simmons-Duffin is our health policy correspondent. She covers the Department of Health and Human Services. And Tom Bowman reports on the Pentagon, the Defense Department. Welcome to all three of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
So, Tom, I'm going to let you kick us off because the Pentagon is in the headlines again this week. We have fallout continuing around Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's fondness for sharing sensitive intel on Signal group chats. We also have news now that several high-level advisors at the Pentagon have departed. What is the climate like there?
Well, Mary Louise, let me share what a former Pentagon official who served in Trump's first term characterized what we're seeing. He called it, quote, the height of dysfunction. So you have the top civilian officials who Hegseth himself brought in, fired or removed, and you have the ongoing problem of classified information being shared with two groups on Signal, one including his wife. It's being investigated by the Pentagon Inspector General. And I'm told Hegseth is slow in putting out releases on decisions that have been made, like keeping U.S. troops in northeast Syria. That was approved by the White House, but it sat on his desk for 2 weeks. Also, there's no word on some upcoming high-level appointments, like who will take over for the top officer at Central Command, General Eric Kurilla, who leaves this summer. That should have been announced some time ago. So dysfunction, delays, and a sense of unease among the senior ranks because of the abrupt firings of senior officers with no reason given.
Michelle Kellerman, how does that line up with what you are tracking at the State Department, which I will note is also in the news this week? We have news of a massive reorganization, including a 15% personnel reduction.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of Secretary of State Marco Rubio's reorganization plan. But, you know, people were a little bit relieved by it because actually some of the proposals that have been floating around would do a lot more to gut the State Department and the professional foreign service. Some of that could still happen. You know, I'm hearing about the possibility of cutting 24 or more overseas posts, for instance. But this was reorganizing with a particular focus on offices that deal with human rights and democracy, things like that. Rubio says that the functions that are required by U.S. law will continue, but he's moved some of them around in his organizational chart, and he's put one of the offices under the control of the coordinator for foreign assistance, which is currently run by someone connected to DOGE.
Selena, what about at the country's many health agencies, which, as you have been reporting for weeks now, are already well into significant job cuts? How are things looking?
Yeah, no signs of relief over at the health agencies. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced what he called an overhaul of HHS in late March and sent out reduction in force notices to about 10,000 staff members on April 1st. And along with the early retirements and other voluntary options, that's a cut of about 25% to HHS staff. And I've been talking to a lot of health agency employees, FDA scientists, senior leaders, policy staff, and the picture that I'm getting is that the full force of the overhaul hasn't been felt yet. The staff that's left has been working to basically hold up a dam, keep experiments running and money flowing to programs like Meals on Wheels and community clinics, but they don't know how long they can keep doing that. And, you know, some staff that will be fired have been told not to go on leave, but to keep working until their jobs officially end on June 2nd. And when that happens, staff say they expect to see the effects really hit the public all over the country in a big way.
Well, let me ask you the why question. Why is Secretary Kennedy doing this? What does he say he's actually trying to accomplish?
Well, he says the country's population is not healthy. Life expectancy is lower than in peer countries, which is true. He says that the science that these agencies have been doing hasn't been good quality and hasn't done enough to address those problems. You know, he's very concerned about the food supply, chronic diseases. But the confusing thing is that many of these cuts seem to work at cross purposes to those goals, like they cut CDC teams that worked on chronic diseases, for example. And so there's a lot of criticism from within HHS, but also health experts beyond, that the cuts were done too fast and haphazardly. I did put in a request this week to talk to Kennedy about his vision for HHS and these cuts, and I did not receive a response.
Well, Michelle Kellerman, I'll put a similar question to you. Has Secretary of State Rubio laid out what he is trying to achieve with U.S. foreign policy with all of these changes at the department he now runs?
Yeah, I mean, he came in talking about how he wants to make this building the center of foreign policy again and talking about respecting the work that federal workers do. But, you know, since that opening speech, he defended the way the Trump administration dismantled the lead U.S. aid agency. He dismantled the group that's been focused on Chinese and Russian propaganda, accusing them without evidence of silencing American conservatives. And he's been a key figure in the negotiations with El Salvador to jail alleged gang members, and he's been actively revoking visas of international students. You know, these are really highly charged political issues here at home, and it's not a comfortable place for diplomats who pride themselves on being nonpartisan.
Tom Bowman, back to the Pentagon. We know that Secretary Hegseth, he has laid out what he says he wants to do. He says the president wants to, quote, restore the warrior ethos of our military. Do we know what that means? Are we seeing a reshaping of the armed forces into more of a warrior ethos?
Well, Mary Louise, I don't think there's really any reshaping of the armed forces. Hegseth has signed off on increased physical standards for all troops and separately tougher standards for those in ground combat positions. That's something he pushed for years as a Fox News personality. He claimed that standards have been lowered so women can get into these combat jobs like infantry, but the Army denies any standards have been lowered. He also claims that there's an increase in recruiting because of Trump, but the Army for more than a year has seen a rise in recruits because of reforms they put in place. You know, Hegseth talks about bringing back a warrior ethos, but I've been going out with soldiers and Marines for two decades in combat zones. That warrior ethos never left.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman, Michelle Kellerman, and Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks to you all for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catholics around the world are preparing for Pope Francis's funeral this Saturday in Rome. Some conservative Catholics in the United States have expressed their expectations for a new pope while offering critiques of the old one. Aleja Hertzler-McCain of Religion News Service reports.
In the days since the pope's death, conservatives have revisited the pope's policies that they disagreed with.
I can't constantly make what Pope Francis is doing and teaching square with previous Catholic tradition.
That's Taylor Marshall on his podcast, The Day Francis Died. Marshall is a podcaster known for his incendiary views on Catholicism. He has been a vocal critic of Francis, saying the Pope did not uphold tradition. New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan offered a more measured response. He told the Today Show he's looking for the next Pope to be a blend of the last few. Someone who might have the heart of Francis, but...
maybe within a little bit of a blend with John Paul and Benedict, when it would come to more, what would I say, more clarity in teaching, more refinement of the church's tradition, more digging in the treasures of the past.
The list of conservatives' issues with Francis includes allowing the blessing of same-sex couples, lifting restrictions on divorced Catholics receiving communion, and his advocacy for the environment and thawing of relations with China. These are all concerns raised during Francis's life. And for his part, Francis accused his critics of being reactionary and substituting ideology for faith. Despite these critiques, Francis remained popular among conservatives in the U.S. In a Pew Research Center poll from February, 7 in 10 Republican-leaning Catholics in the U.S. had a favorable view of Francis. Catherine Jean Lopez is religion editor at the National Review.
The death of Pope Francis really is the experience for a lot of us of the death of a spiritual father.
Lopez said she appreciated Francis's commitment to prayer, especially for persecuted Christians, his advocacy against abortion, and concern for all human life.
From almost the beginning, he was kind of seen as a progressive. Liberals supported him, conservatives opposed him, was kind of the trend, right? It is more complicated than that.
Lopez said she hopes the selection of the next pope is a prayerful decision guided by the Holy Spirit. She also hopes Catholics won't reduce him to U.S. political terms. For NPR News, I'm Aleja Hertzler-McCain.
This story is from a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service.
Spring is here, and with it, in the leaves and in the grass, the color green.
But none of the green you'll see this year, well, that you'll ever see, is as green as Olo.
That is a new color that you can only see in a lab at UC Berkeley using a laser. It's been described in the journal Science Advances.
So how does it work? Well, it starts with a device called Oz.
Yes, of Emerald City fame.
It uses tiny laser pulses to individually activate cone cells.
Those are special cells in the retina that see different wavelengths of light. Oz can activate any combination of cones and thus produce any technicolor image.
But Oz can also be dialed in to just activate the cones that can see green. In nature, that would never happen. But in the lab, that's how you get Olo.
Participants describe it as resembling the emerald green of a peacock, but saturated to a level they've never experienced.
Scientists say the technology could help those with eye diseases and even color blindness in the future. But for now, Oz is staying in the lab.
And if you hope to see Olo one day, well, YOLO.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juan Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. On the fictional island of Carpathia, if you go into the forests at night, you might sense that you're being watched. And if you peer into the trees, you may just spot an elusive primate called the Ochi.
Ochi is simply the word they use for eyes, which is all they ever see of them when they shine their flashlights.
Isaiah Saxon is the writer and director of the new adventure movie, The Legend of Ochi.
The rest of the world thinks the Ochi are nothing more than a myth, but the people who live amongst them in remote villages come in contact with them. And that's where conflict arises, because they are a threat to their way of life.
In the movie, a little girl resolves to reunite a stranded baby Ochi with its family, rejecting her own family's tradition of demonizing and hunting the animals.
But he's my friend.
We can't be friends with them. They can't be our pets. We have turned a wolf into a lapdog.
Filmmaker Isaiah Saxon told me he wanted to tap into his own childhood fascination with a mysterious primate.
Growing up, I feel like I was always chasing the mysteries of nature. So I grew up in the mountains around Santa Cruz County. It was all redwood forest and oak forest, and you know, I would just get lost. And I grew up around a lot of people who really did believe in Sasquatch. It wasn't like a silly thing like Bigfoot. It was like, there's a North American great ape and it's out there.
I grew up in Oregon, so I share that experience.
Exactly, yeah. When that's kind of the world you grew up in, and you're out there in the forest alone, you think that you're seeing things, you think that you're encountering things, and you think that you might always be one step away from, you know, the great magical experience. And so because of that kind of luminous feeling being out in the forest, it feels real to you.
The Ochi is not a Sasquatch. It does not resemble a Sasquatch. Will you describe these creatures for us?
Yeah, the Ochi are an elusive fictional primate species indigenous to a fictional island in the Black Sea called the Island of Carpathia. And they communicate with a whistled animal language that is musical in nature.
When I was a kid, I wrote a paper on an animal called a tarsier. And when I watched this movie, I was like, oh, they look a lot like tarsiers.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I was trying to invent a fictional primate, the goal was really to make an animal that could reasonably be misunderstood by the audience and especially kids as an actual species. Like maybe you just hadn't yet seen the BBC Nature documentary on these these new primates, you know, because we still are discovering new primates. So I really wanted to draw from existing patterns in nature when I was designing these creatures. So I was looking a lot at the Chinese golden snub-nosed monkey, which is an endangered primate in remote China.
And it has kind of a blue face and golden fur surrounding it.
Exactly. Yeah, they've become kind of charismatic stars recently. You've probably seen them around. and as well as, you named it, the tarsiers, for their hands.
Wait, so I was right? That was actually one of the inspirations?
100%.
Amazing.
No, I was I found this video.
They have such huge eyes.
Yeah, exactly. It's the eyes and the hands, too.
Yeah.
The hands are like, they're almost like
little suction cup fingers. Yeah.
Yeah. Like long fingers, which also kind of reminded me of the hands that E.T. had that kind of like were lodged in my brain.
To me, the Ochi, the animals in this movie, had almost like a Jim Henson feel. It reminded me of Fraggle Rock or The Dark Crystal. The baby Ochi is a puppet, and the older ones are inhabited by human puppeteers, performers, actors. At a time when CGI is everywhere, why did you decide to go that route?
I think there's something so ancient about puppeteering that you immediately accept as alive. Even if I am staring at the puppeteer, you know, I can see the puppet and the puppeteer all in one. My mind can even remove that puppeteer and I can completely accept this thing as a living being in front of me.
And so it's not whether it looks realistic in the way that CGI might look realistic. You're talking about tapping into something evolutionary.
Yeah, it's more on an unconscious level, do we accept something as alive? Hmm. And so, and that, as you point out, that's different than realism. Realism has to do with like how many little details that are technically correct can we add, but often that's a losing game. And so I think I knew it had to be a puppet and the adult Ochi had to be suit performers. And part of the puppetry and the magic of it is also animatronics. So this is essentially just compact robotic faces that are remote controlled.
Do you remember the first time you saw the Ochi puppet, how you reacted?
The very first prototype was just this naked, hairless puppet that had no facial movement whatsoever. And the day I arrived in London to meet all the puppeteers, they started showing me what it could do. And I was just immediately overjoyed. This was real. This is this creature is real and it's in front of me and it doesn't even have a moving face yet or hair on it or anything. And so that's when I knew the approach was going to work. And then I remember later after we were greenlit, I got to work with them in the studio as they were working on the face, and the face was just like mounted to a desk, and it's just the front of it. There's no there's no back, there's no ears, anything. And just seeing the movement on it and the life in its face, you know, I couldn't help but like reach out and touch it, and it bit my finger. And I was just like,
oh my God, that's
great. I think at that point, I was like, Carl, I'm going to kiss you, like the wonderful animatronics designer. So, yeah.
I'm thinking about you saying that as a kid, you were always chasing the mysteries of nature, and now you've made this film about this kind of wondrous experience in nature. And I hope it's okay for me to ask this. You recently lost your home in the horrible Southern California wildfires. How do you feel about nature now, today?
Oh, my respect only deepens. You know, it's like, I feel like the sense of awe is really the sense of being small and okay with your smallness. And as I've now experienced like a direct smallness in the face of nature, I could only offer more respect to nature. And I also think that like the more you lose, the bigger your heart gets. And so nature has grown my heart one more notch.
Isaiah Saxon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
He's the writer and director of The Legend of Ochi, which is in theaters now.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
The public is pouring in to view Pope Francis's remains before his funeral Saturday. As mourners continue to grieve, cardinals from around the world will soon prepare to elect the next leader of the world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics. We'll tell you what's in store as global figures pay their last respects to the first pontiff from Latin America on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. For decades, the American Psychological Association has required graduate programs to consider diversity in admissions.
As the Trump administration seeks more influence in college accreditation, the APA is pausing the requirement.
This was not a decision that was done lightly at all, and a difficult one.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The United States has proposed the framework for a potential peace deal between Russia and Ukraine that would give Russia sovereignty over Crimea in addition to the land it has seized since the invasion. It would also bar Ukraine from joining NATO. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says he can't predict how Russian President Vladimir Putin will respond to peace talks.
I worked with him for 4 years between 2010 and 2014. I stopped trying to read his mind. We'll see, but there is something on the table now, I think, where the Ukrainians are really playing ball. I think the ball is clearly in the Russian court now.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky rejected the terms of the proposal, emphasizing that Ukraine will not cede any territory or alter its constitutional stance. A federal judge in Georgia is deciding whether to extend legal relief for more than 100 international students who had their legal status revoked or changed by the Trump administration. Sam Greenglass from member station WABE reports the case is the largest among several similar lawsuits around the country.
The judge has already granted a temporary restraining order, restoring the student's previous status for 14 days. The judge is now considering a preliminary injunction, extending that as the case continues. The student's lawyer, Charles Cook, says without one, they'd face irreparable harm.
They come from places where their parents have sacrificed to send them here. And to simply say, go home now and come back later and fix it, as if they're made out of money.
U.S. Attorney David Powell told the judge there is no irreparable harm. He could not answer how authorities decided whose status to revoke, but said they properly applied immigration laws. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
This is NPR News. Authorities in New Jersey say a 19-year-old man is facing charges of arson in connection with a wildfire that's burned more than 13,000 acres. Joseph Kling is accused of failing to properly extinguish a bonfire that sparked the wildfire near Toms River. It forced thousands of people to evacuate their homes. Officials say the blaze is about 50% contained. Today is the 35th anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that this workhorse of astronomy is still doing important science.
The telescope is the size of a school bus, and to get it into orbit over 300 miles up, it took a space shuttle.
2, 1, and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery with the Hubble Space Telescope, our window on the universe.
Soon after its launch in 1990, NASA discovered the telescope's primary mirror was flawed. This Hubble trouble resulted in much public mockery. But once astronauts installed corrective optics, Hubble's gorgeous images became part of popular culture, on everything from lunchboxes to U-Haul rental trucks. The aging observatory mostly still works great, though it's operating on just one gyroscope, and astronomers still clamor to use it. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. In Florida, GOP Governor Ron DeSantis has been put on the defensive by questions about how $10 million in state money was used to fund a political campaign. DeSantis has spent two terms as governor, and the Republican-controlled legislature has strongly supported him. But now Republicans in the state House of Representatives say the alleged misuse of funds may warrant a criminal investigation. NPR's Greg Allen is in Miami. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Ari.
Explain what's going on here.
Well, this is about $10 million in funds that was paid to Florida by Centene. That's a company that provides managed care to Medicaid recipients. The money was part of a $67 million settlement that was paid by the company after it was charged with overbilling taxpayers for medications. $10 million of the money was paid to a nonprofit group, Hope Florida. Now, that's a charity that was founded by Governor DeSantis' wife, Casey, to help people move from government assistance into community-based programs. An investigation in Florida's House of Representatives found that after receiving it, Hope Florida then transferred the $10 million to two dark money political groups. And, you know, those are groups that aren't required to disclose their donors. The two groups then sent some $8.5 million to a political committee that was campaigning against an amendment to legalize recreational marijuana in Florida. That committee was controlled by DeSantis's then chief of staff, now Florida Attorney General, James Uthmeyer. Republican lawmakers, including Representative Alex Andrade, say they believe that that was illegal.
Simply put, there's no question that these were Medicaid funds steered by the governor's chief of staff through secret and clandestine actions to his own political committee.
How does Governor DeSantis defend this?
Well, this is the most visible sign we've seen of this growing rift between Republican lawmakers and Governor DeSantis. The investigation in Florida's House doesn't target him directly, but the political campaign to defeat the marijuana initiative was led by DeSantis, and you know, it was successful, by the way. Since these allegations arose, DeSantis has been fighting back, saying there's no story here, and he's held a series of news conferences where he's attacked the news media and Republican lawmakers.
The whole thing that the House leadership's doing is a manufactured fraud. This is a hoax. They are trying to smear one of the most successful programs anywhere in the country.
You know, one of the most, the many issues here is that DeSantis' administration didn't tell Florida's legislature about that big $67 million settlement or about the $10 million that went directly to a charity overseen by First Lady Casey DeSantis.
And then you mentioned the other state official at the center of these allegations, Florida's Attorney General. What's his response here?
Well, you know, according to the House investigation, James Uthmeyer was the person who initiated the plan to divert some of the settlement money to groups campaigning against the marijuana referendum. Uthmeyer, as we mentioned, was DeSantis' chief of staff at the time. In February, after all these events had taken place, DeSantis then appointed him attorney general. Uthmeyer denies allegations that he was the mastermind behind this deal. He says he has looked at the settlement and believes it was legal and that the $10 million that went to the dark money groups wasn't actually Medicaid money. Representative Andrade says that's a legalistic argument and he simply isn't buying it.
$10 million is a lot of money in the real world, right? If someone defrauded the state or a charity out of $10 million, they would go to prison.
Well, where does the investigation go from here?
Well, Representative Andrade says he's concluded his investigation and is now up to federal prosecutors to decide whether they're going to pursue criminal charges. He says he's spoken to the Department of Justice. When I reached out to the DOJ, they told me no comment. Even if there are no criminal charges, one person who's possibly hurt by all this is Casey DeSantis. She seems to be preparing her own run for governor. President Trump, though, has already endorsed a candidate in the governor's race in Florida. That's Republican Congressman Byron Donalds. But if Casey DeSantis does get in the race, these allegations about a charity that she founded that may be involved in shady dealings certainly doesn't help her.
That's NPR's Greg Allen in Miami. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration wants greater influence over college accreditation. Eliminating diversity and inclusion criteria from the admissions process is part of that push, which can have far-reaching implications in the coming years. But what does that look like in practice? As NPR's Katia Riddle reports, the answer may come in how we decide who gets to become a psychologist.
For every slot in a clinical psychology program, there are a plethora of qualified candidates. Who gets selected can come down to tiny differences or preferences. John DeVideo is a psychologist at Yale. He has seen the admissions process up close over many years.
What that does is often leads to the fact that you can have a white and a black candidate who are just as good.
For years, there wasn't explicit guidance around prioritizing diversity, equity, and inclusion, and psychology used to be a field dominated by white men.
You fall back on the heuristic of, this person's like me, I'm a good person, I'm going to take this person.
In recent decades, the American Psychological Association made a significant effort to diversify the field. That's why their accreditation board started requiring graduate programs to take diversity into consideration when it comes to admissions. Aaron Joyce is APA's Senior Director of Accreditation.
The commission certainly sees individual and cultural diversity as a core part of what is required to be a competent psychologist.
Not just race, but less visible factors like urban and rural geography or sexual orientation and identity. After Trump's executive order on DEI, however, graduate programs are feeling legal pressure to reverse course and eliminate it from their criteria. That's why Joyce said the Psychology Accreditation Board has paused the requirement.
This was not a decision that was done lightly at all, and a difficult one.
Joyce says the members of the accreditation board were worried they were putting graduate programs into impossible circumstances. If they kept the requirement, it could lead to programs losing accreditation altogether. He stresses that they are still emphasizing the importance of DEI in other ways. Melba Vasquez is a psychologist. She says she was among the first generation to benefit from this policy.
They were attentive to the importance in 1974 when I was admitted into the program. To start admitting students of color.
Back then it wasn't called DEI, but it had a similar impact.
I and a small number of other minority students over the next couple of years were admitted into the program.
She's gone on to become a leader in her field. Diversity among psychologists is not about optics, she says. It's about better care.
It makes us more available to serve the populations and the communities that we live in, but we also can influence our colleagues to develop cultural competency, to understand how to better deliver services to people from our communities.
She's disappointed in this decision to pause DEI requirements in psychology programs, she says. But she acknowledges the difficulty. She doesn't envy her colleagues who had to make the decision.
I don't know whether I would have pushed for a different decision.
In response to an inquiry about this story, the Department of Justice referred NPR to a memo promising the DOJ would, quote, investigate, eliminate, and penalize illegal DEI programs in educational institutions that receive federal funds, end quote. Vasquez says the Commission on Accreditation and the APA do not have the same resources as other institutions to fight something like this.
You know, we can't help but admire Harvard, for example, for standing up to, you know, the executive orders.
Vasquez is hopeful the people who run graduate programs will continue to choose to prioritize diversity, even if it's not required, when they select the next generation of psychologists. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's been a little over 3 months since the devastating wildfires here in Southern California. As residents try to pick up the pieces, officials have begun issuing rebuilding permits for homes and other buildings. Climate activists hope to persuade people to go all electric, which is in line with California's goals to reduce greenhouse gases. But as NPR's Jeff Brady reports, not everyone is ready to make the change.
In Altadena, California, these sounds are everywhere. Heavy equipment clears debris from the Eaton and Palisades wildfires, leaving a dirt lot for rebuilding.
We're on Glen Rose Avenue. Sorry, there's a street sweeper going by.
As the cleanup transitions to rebuilding, Jaime Rodriguez is in front of his burned home, looking where the garage used to be.
I had a classic BMW M Roadster in there. Unfortunately, I could only take one of the cars with me.
With the burned car hauled away, Rodriguez says he plans to rebuild a more climate-friendly, all-electric home.
No, there will be no gas in the next one. The only thing I had for gas in this house was just for the water heater.
Rodriguez started transitioning his home to electric before the fire. He replaced a gas furnace with a more efficient electric heat pump, and now he'll cut off gas service to his rebuilt home. That was an easy decision for him. But for people who haven't thought about switching to electric appliances, it's more difficult. A mile down the hill, past the burned elementary school, Lupe Sanchez's home was damaged but is still standing. She says switching to all electric never occurred to her.
No, I haven't heard anything about that at all.
Okay. Is gas service important to you?
Well, yeah, that's how I cook. That's how I had my dryer running, you know, on gas.
Natural gas is mostly methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. California buildings make up about a quarter of the state's climate pollution, much of that from burning gas. That's why the state has a plan to transition from gas to electric in buildings and zero out the state's climate pollution by 2045.
This has been viewed largely as a problem for the future.
Josh Lappin is a researcher at the University of Notre Dame who studies the expansion and contraction of energy systems such as gas utilities. He says across the country, these networks of pipes and equipment will have to shrink in coming decades to meet greenhouse gas reduction goals.
What a neighborhood scale disaster like these fires has done is bring this potential crisis forward into the 2020s.
And right now, regulators and policymakers are reluctant to force people who just lost their homes to also give up the personal choice to have gas in their new home. So for now, that's a choice being made house by house.
As much as I would love to see an all-electric future, I do think that's probably the right approach.
Becky Minton is the California director at the Building Decarbonization Coalition. To convince homeowners to rebuild with electric appliances, her group is providing information and technical help. One of the more compelling arguments is that electrification can save money.
Overall, we estimate that you can save somewhere between $7,000 to $10,000 by building an all-electric home as opposed to a dual-fuel home.
In part because there's no need to install gas pipes in the new home. That saves on construction costs. The local gas utility, SoCalGas, says it already has restored service to about half of the 30,000 customers affected by the Eaton and Palisades fires. Climate groups are talking now with people who lost their homes, so they understand early in the rebuilding process that they can choose all electric. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Altadena.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's re-election was once seen as a potential boon for right-wing politicians around the world. But with elections next week in Canada and Australia, Trump's trade war and harsh words for allies have made him a liability for conservatives outside the U.S. NPR's Scott Newman reports.
It wasn't long ago that Pierre Poilievre, the leader of Canada's opposition Conservative Party, was riding high. The incumbent Liberal Party, with an unpopular Prime Minister Justin Trudeau at the helm, was looking historically weak. In a page right out of Trump's playbook, Poilievre's message of tax cuts, downsizing Canada's government, and ending woke ideology was resonating with voters. But Trump's tariffs and talk of annexing Canada changed all that, forcing Poilievre into damage control mode. Here he is speaking in February.
So let me be clear. We will never be the 51st state.
In recent weeks, Canada's Liberals, now under Prime Minister Mark Carney following Trudeau's resignation, have staged a strong comeback, says Semra Sevi, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Toronto.
And now we're talking about them possibly forming a majority government. So in 3 months, that's a major shift in Canadian politics.
In Australia too, a Trump bump for right-wing populists has turned into a Trump slump. Opposition candidate Peter Dutton leads a two-party coalition. He initially touted a down-under version of MAGA, but now he's trying to distance himself from Trump. Here he is at a recent campaign stop being questioned by a reporter.
You want to make Australia great again?
I want to get rid of a bad government. That's what I want to do.
Ryan Neelam is director of the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. He says Trump's tariffs have hit a nerve with voters, and as a result,
the coalition seems to be in survival mode right now.
Neelam says in the last year, trust in the U.S. has plunged to a record low. Now, only about a third of Australians say they have any trust in the U.S. to act responsibly on the world stage. Scott Newman, NPR News.
Thousands of people from around the world are filing into St. Peter's Basilica in Rome to view the body of Pope Francis as he lies in state. As tributes to the Pope pour in, there is renewed focus on his willingness to enter the political arena. He was outspoken on almost every modern issue facing the world, from social justice to the treatment of migrants to global climate change. For many, he was a symbol of change, but he was also criticized for not taking enough action to address the issues of marginalized groups within the Catholic Church. To talk about the legacy of Pope Francis, we called up Anthea Butler, who is the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, for so many people, I think that Pope Francis's presence signaled the possibility for change and progress for the Catholic Church, which is, of course, a centuries-old institution. I wonder if you can give us an example or two of communities that advocated for change and what they were hoping to see from Francis that perhaps will endure beyond his years.
Sure. I mean, I think first, obviously I think about the LGBTQ community, and I think of somebody like Father James Martin, who worked with Pope Francis a lot and has worked with these communities and has a ministry that, you know, deeply involves Catholics who are gay or lesbian, right? And I think that for one of the things that they really wanted from Francis was to see progress. And one of those moments of progress was advocating for same-sex blessings, which caused an uproar in other parts of the church and the world, right? Because people were like, oh, you can't do this, whatever. But, you know, the reality was that people were doing those things a lot on the sly anyway. And so what Francis did was recognize what the pastoral care part was. It's not a marriage. It was a blessing. And, you know, even a blessing for some portions of the church would see that as anathema to Catholic teaching. So I think that's one thing.
The Catholic Church has historically had a complicated history when it comes to addressing racism. And Pope Francis was someone who we saw visibly work to promote inclusivity, to show that the church was a place that had space for everyone. I mean, I personally remember back in 2020 after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, when Pope Francis came out and prayed for him and made the point that Catholics can't tolerate racism and in the same breath claim to defend the sacredness of every human life. And still, some Black Catholics have said that They felt left out, that they wanted to see more. I'd love to ask you, what do you think that Pope Francis's legacy will be specifically among Black Catholics?
I mean, I think for the most part, Black Catholics are going to see him as a transformational pope, in the sense that they felt seen. This was a pope that actually visited, you know, Africa 10 times, you know, different countries, different ways of dealing with the African continent. If we think about racism in terms of the way that we think about American racism, it might not be apparent, and it might not be the thing that, you know, Black Catholics in America would have hoped for. But what I do think is very important is his openness to the African diaspora. And I think that's key. The things that he did, you know, the cardinals he appointed, you know, it's very important to see that he appointed somebody in the Caribbean. I think those things are the things that will stand. Can he deal with the kind of racism that we have here in America with American Catholics? And I need to say that up front, because it's very important to say that we don't have a great situation in terms of race and racism in the Catholic Church here in America. It will take something different for a pope, the next pope, to step into and speak into. But I think Francis spoke into it as much as he could.
Cardinals are converging on Rome to pick the next pope, though we'll note that the process has not yet begun. I wonder, for you personally, do you go into the conclave with more hope or more apprehension in terms of who the next pope might be and the direction in which that person might take the church?
I'd have to say maybe it's more hope than apprehension. I mean, you know, there's this whole thing about, oh, you know, it's going to be conservative, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, we have to remember that Pope Francis installed over 100 of these cardinals, right? And there's very few people that are left from, you know, John Paul II or Pope Benedict, right? So I think in that, what we have to see is that this church has changed. This is a global church, and it always has been a global church. The problem is that most of the time when cardinals were picked, they used to come from, you know, Italy or Europe or something like that. And so Francis was different in two ways. He came from Latin America, and he was a Jesuit, which, you know, is an order that does not have ecclesiastical dignities. In other words, they don't, you know, ascribe to be bishops or cardinals or anything like that. So I think that this may just be a different one. And this is kind of open to conjecture. I see all the people now taking their list up, but, you know, it may not be somebody we expect.
That's Anthea Butler, the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T.